You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You have my sword.
And you have my bow.
And my trowel.
Hi, you're listening to episode 62 of At My Trowel, where we look at the fantastic side of archaeology and the archaeological side of fantasy. I'm Ash.
And I'm Tilly.
And this is the second part of our discussion with professional potter Emma Harrison, chatting all about cute little clay dragons.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. She's there. I swear, we haven't tied her up and put her back in the car. She's still with us. So let's just remind ourselves of our current quest. So we have been approached by the Penny Kettle Dragon Sanctuary to help them analyse their current collection of dragon figurines. They're trying to showcase basically the diversity and the uniqueness of their collection, which, as we discovered in the literature review of the last episode, is quite unique, actually, because there's not that many clay figurines that come to life. So they want to have as deep an analysis as possible. So not just, you know, typology and cataloging category, but also an investigation into things like material, firing technique, etc., etc. And of course, this analysis is a little bit more complicated than just cataloging, because they come to life for all who actually believe they come to life, which, I mean, the three of us do believe it, right? So that's gonna be a bit of a problem. So we already had a little bit of a look into our literature review in the last episode, where we looked at how sort of living clay figurines and other sentient objects have cropped up in fantasy. But how about archaeology? So we talked a little bit about that last episode. Ash, our classics expert.
Sorry. Sorry for listeners, I didn't mean to scream there.
By classics episode, I mean the one of us who has done one class in classical archaeology.
I did a year, thank you very much, Tilly.
Well, I mean, go ahead.
I read Herodotus.
Just join the Pass Macabre and talk all about, you know, classical archaeology.
No, I didn't do Egypt. I did Greek
Egypt
and Roman.
Is
Egypt
different from classic?
I think it's
is it not counted?
Different, depends on the antiquity.
Oh, I guess, because the older Egyptian. Again, listeners, if you're listening in, this is just goes to show that just because someone is an archaeologist doesn't mean they are familiar with everything.
Yeah, I don't know anything about Roanoke, and I don't know anything about aliens or anything like that. We don't know it, okay? So sorry.
Yeah, we do have the treasure. Yeah.
No.
Anyway. And we mentioned in the last episode that there was that sort of ancient Greek mythology is that humans were made from clay. And I think you mentioned that there was like Egyptian pottery god, Ash?
Yeah, Khnum. He's the potter who molds beings on a potter's wheel from clay.
Oh, there you go. So it's similar, I guess. That sort of overview.
Yeah, the molding of people. And then fire, like Prometheus is fire. And he was famously shaped humans from like mud and water and gave them fire. So like, the spark of life is fire. And I think in Frankenstein they talk about that too, how the, because it's Prometheus reborn, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and how fire and clay and all that kind of stuff is what makes us who we are, that we are basically mud and be to be shaped in ever whatever way you want us to be shaped.
Oh, that's very deep. That's very deep.
I know. Mary Shelley, man.
Quit. And I mean, as a potter yourself, Emma, do you have any favourite archaeological examples of kind of ancient pottery?
Yeah, it's actually one from Scotland, so people might have heard of the Westray Wifey. It's a wee figure Neolithic Orkney. Mm-hmm. So there's a famous figurine called the Westray Wifey, which is actually made of sandstone. It's like 5,000 years old or so. Mm-hmm. But there's also another one that was found in the same kind of area, found in a midden. And it's made of clay, but it's not a complete one. So, yeah, the Westray Wifey is a complete little figurine about 4 centimetres tall with a little body and a head. Mm-hmm. But the clay version that was found is only the body, so it's missing the head. And it's about 3.5 centimetres tall, the body. So it's probably about the same size, and it seems a similar sort of, you know, style to the Westray Wifey that was found. So it was probably pretty similar.
Yeah.
But the clay one, it's got some kind of markings on it that are a bit different that maybe show a bit of the clothing styles and things. So, yeah, it's really cool. I love that. And it's some of the earliest sort of depictions of human beings that have been found in the British Isles and stuff as well. So, yeah, I love that.
Yeah. Well, I actually love the earliest ever clay object, like the oldest clay object that we found is also depiction of a, well, they're pretty sure it's a female because she has very large breasts, which is the Venus of Donya Vestonice, which is about 30,000 years old, so like Upper Paleolithic, and found in the Czech Republic at the site of Dolny Vestonice. And she's also like, that's also one of the Venus figurines, so the old like women figure, which and you mentioned the Venus of Willendorf, Ash, in the last one, so those ones are definitely interesting, which I wonder if they already had then those mythologies then, and that's why they're making people out of clay.
I mean,
yeah, there almost must be something, right?
Yeah,
it's very instinctual to just like pick up, like that's what I used to do on site when I was bored. If there was some clay that wasn't part of the context, like in the side of the section or something, like of the trench, not like anything archaeological, you'd sort of pick it up, you'd get a bit of water, and then you'd sort of just make like tiny little Venuses as I was watching a digger, you know, that's work, right? And stuff. And then you'd leave them to dry in the sun, and then they would just be there, and you'd be like, oh, I've got these tiny little figurines, and I don't know what to do. Oh, like little pinch pots and things like that you'd just kind of mess with and play with. And yeah, and also you're around fire all the time, like people are firing stuff constantly, and you find that archaeologically all this crap pot that people all daub that just hasn't really worked, especially in Scotland. It's full of pots, like especially Neolithic pits and middens, like I remember saying about middens and the Westry Wifey and stuff. So yeah, I think there's something kind of instinctual about fiddling with clay.
Yeah, which is what you were kind of talking about last episode as well anyway, right, Emma? Because you said you were brought up sort of around clay. So I suppose if people living in prehistory had something similar, it would make sense to just make little figurines and sort of play around with them. And
yeah, I think so at least. And I always find it tricky to, you know, the interpretations of these little figurines that are found are often quite deep and sort of spiritual and religious in a way, you know, sort of they're seen as Venuses and goddesses and
hang
things.
On.
But
hang on a second, we got
we had a ritual.
We've got a the ritual buzzer's gone.
Oh my god. It was a ritual. No, it's gone forever.
Well, sorry listeners, you won't get the ritual buzzer this time. But ritual, there we go. I'll just do a little but yes, no, sorry, I was interrupting you with my excitement about pressing the ritual buzzer. But yeah, you reckon they're not, probably not actually quite that ritualistic.
Well, they could be. They totally could be.
Yeah.
But it could also just be the other end of the scale where someone just made something that was fun and they were making a portrait of their friend or their mum or whatever, you know? It could just be quite unimportant in a way, you know what I mean? Just quite mundane and everyday, just someone doing something fun just to fiddle with for a few minutes or something.
Yeah,
there's been a few studies into looking at fingerprints on clay, because you do find little pieces of finger, like you can see it a lot on pottery as well, people's fingerprints, which I love. I found one and I remember looking at it, going, oh my god, that's a man's fingerprint from 6,000 years ago. Oh, that's so cool. And I can't remember the site, so I'll have to try and find it, and I'll link it in the show notes, because I did a study on it in uni years ago, and it was these little tiny figurines and pinch pots and stuff, and they found that the fingerprint sizes were likely children that were making them. And so it's kind of teaching, like learning how to make pots or figurines or something, or toys. They didn't know, because toy is such a loaded label in material culture. We never know what a toy would be, because anything can be a toy. You know, a box can be a toy.
Yeah.
So we just from experience. You know what can't be a toy? That super expensive toy that you brought them for their birthday. That can't be a toy. That's not interesting. They will not play with that.
But the sock on the ground that's been there for 2 days, that is the toy.
That's the best toy ever. And heaven forbid you try and throw that away. Anyway, sorry.
But yeah, you find that children are learning stuff, like, you know, those kind of maybe key skills in prehistory that are needed, like making pottery, flints, things like that, maybe earlier. And you get that kind of apprentice pieces, they always call them. So there was there's a site that has a few of those where they've measured the fingerprints and they realize that they're children making them, which is really cool.
Although that's actually also with the Venus of Donya Vestonice, she has a fingerprint on her back that they discovered through like a later one, and they reckon that it might be a child's fingerprint. But I actually, on one of my first episodes of Tea Break time travel, as was now Tea Break Archaeology, I chatted with Sarah Lord from Potted History about the Venus of Dolly Pestinitze, and she reckons it was probably more that, you know, a child was sort of handed it before it got fired, and then, you know, the fingerprint was on it, or it just sort of prodded it or poked it, because it's kind of just above the backside, so she reckons that it was more of a kind of, yeah, like, here, you know? Which, again, is just that sort of everydayness, right, which I love, kind of bringing it back in.
Yeah.
And you have, so it wasn't clay, but I did a study as part of my PhD research on little carved ivory figurines from the Paleo-Inuit Dorset culture. And again, there's so much. It's so funny. As soon as you start having things like figurines, basically something that's non-functional, archaeologists just go mad talking about symbolic significance and everything. But it's so funny because you would never have that conversation if it was like just a everyday object, you know? And so it's what's to say that these weren't just everyday objects indeed. I always find it interesting how there's always that assumption that if it's a little figurine, it has to have some sort of significance.
Yeah, always. Yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, fair. Because you make, so just going back to Bogbourne Crafts, Emma, because you make the cups and everything. So, you know, they're, I guess, functional objects, the everyday objects. But then you also do make little figurines as well.
Yeah, well, I make I call them replicas, but they're made in clay. I make the Westray wifey, but a version in clay, for example. Yeah. So obviously
I make her in
material.
Wax, so like, you know.
Yeah, nice.
I mean, who doesn't make the Westray wifey?
Yeah. It's a great object.
Me.
Yeah.
You can make things stone. Like...
Yeah, there you go.
There's things like medieval lobed cups. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of those. So there are these communal cups that would be passed around a group. So a group drinking vessel, you know, so it's got often several handles and it might have several sort of shaped lips on the edge of the cup where different people can drink from and things like this.
Oh, cool.
And usually inside the cup, they have a little figurine. So something like a little dog or a knight or something. So that will stick out of the sort of drink, you know, you'll see it sticking out as the cup drains. More of it revealed, which is really fun, I think. So, yeah, sometimes in archaeology, you just find the figurine that used to be in the center. It gets sort of broken and detached, and you'll just find the figurine. And then, yeah, if you piece it together, it's actually from a lobed cup, but it just seems like a separate figurine. So sometimes I'll just make the figurine from the cup, or I'll make the whole cup, you know?
Yeah. That's cool. Oh, that's it's like those cute ones people have where there's like a spider in the bottom. Have you ever seen those?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're drinking them, they go, oh my God.
Yeah.
That would be horrifying. Yeah. Please never do that to me.
I think I have a commission for you from Ashes.
You better bloody not, I swear. Because I'll forget, I know I will, and I'll keep drinking, and I'll be the bloody spider.
So yeah, and I mean, the nice thing, obviously what we're talking about now is kind of, well, medieval is a bit later, I guess, but a lot of the ones that we're talking about come from prehistory. But you do have ones from, for example, ancient Egyptian sites, the Shwaptis, are they called Shwaptis? The little figurines, which were actually introduced to me by Jess, who has been on the podcast before, and who is actually aware of these things about ancient Egypt. And apologies, Jess, if you're listening and you're like, what? They're not called Shwaptis? What are you talking about, Matilda? But they're the figurines that are quite often made from clay or carved from stone that are basically put in to kind of represent the servants of the pharaoh that's being entombed. So then they'll be buried with all these little figurines, these little Shwaptis, who are then going to be their servants in the afterlife, basically, and serve them. But those, we sort of know what they are for because it's kind of documented in a way in that respect, which I find quite interesting. And then you have like the terracotta warriors, of course, which were the first ones I thought of when I was thinking of clay.
Yeah.
I don't know if you'd call them a figurine.
They're definitely not. They're life size.
They're big.
Some figurine.
Yeah, which is quite interesting. And actually, I heard a very interesting episode. This is a random plug for a completely different podcast called You're Dead to Me, which I was listening to one about. I can't remember what the overall topic was, but it featured part of the terracotta warriors. And did you know they have individualized faces? So
yes.
Each face is a little bit different.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I did not know that. It's amazing.
That's why, so there was a guy that jumped into them like a few, I think it was last year or the year before, and like broke one of them. Yeah, and he started trying to push them, which is like ridiculous. It's all terracotta. But yeah, he broke one of them and you were like, why did you do that, sir? Why did you jump in? So I remember that coming up because they're all very unique and then it's difficult to replicate them again.
Maybe the ones we were talking about last episode, you know, the dittos or whatever, where people just make clay versions of themselves.
Every time you think of, of the Pokemon Ditto, that takes the form of every other Pokemon. Every time you say Ditto.
There you go. Well, maybe that's it.
He's
maybe
not clay, though.
Massive clay Pokemon.
Oh my god, clay Pokemon.
Really, that's Diglett, isn't it?
That's Diglett is the digging little mole ones.
I thought you said Piglet. I was like, wait, what?
No, Diglett. One's a really obvious one. There's like a microwave one and stuff. They sort of ran out of ideas and there's like a microwave and a fridge. And there's not really. But I think there is actually. There's some, definitely some weird ones, the newest ones. But the older ones, yeah, Ditto was the kind of purple blob that would take on the form of... Anyway, let's stop talking about Pokemon.
Hang on. I will stop you because I've just seen that one of the figurines that we're trying to kind of experimentally fire at the moment has just walked out of the kiln. So maybe we should stop him before he sets something on fire. One second, we'll be right back. Okay, the figurine's back in the kiln and promises to wait until he's cooled off a bit before coming out again.
I should hope so. He'll fall apart. Okay, so we've thought of some examples from archaeology. So we know that the clay figurines can be very important and there's ways to typologize them. But what about learning more about archaeological clays? Emma, perhaps you can help us.
Yeah, because I mean, I can do a little bit of thin sectioning like petrography, but if I just look at a clay... I have absolutely no idea how old it is or where it's from, which is a real bummer at work, I can tell you, because I'm supposed to be cataloguing things. But are you able to look at sort of also archaeological clays and kind of have a rough idea of what time period they come from, what might be inside them, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, if you've read enough about the different typologies and things, you do start to get an idea of, you know, when they're from and the sort of culture it might have come from and things. But that really is just a case of staring at the typologies and reading about the dates and things and just memorizing that, I suppose.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you've got an archaeological ceramic in front of you, I think you can tell a lot sort of materially about it, at least.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to get information about sort of the form of the pot, whether it was curved, flat, had different indents and shaping on it and things.
Mm.
You can tell a bit about the sort of fabric of the clay. So that's just the clay itself and any things that were added to it. So potters in the past and even today would add stuff called temper. So they might take crushed up ceramic or they might take sand or crushed seashells, things like that, and add it into the clay. And that temper sort of stops things cracking when you fire it and also stops it cracking when you're cooking with it. So if it's something like a cooking pot that gets used on the fire, you want that sort of sand and added stuff to help stop, you know, cracks spreading throughout the clay and just help a bit with thermal shock and things like that. So,
which you'd probably need with these little dragon figurines because they do, what's it called? Oh God, breathe fire. I was about to say belch fire.
They breathe.
They breathe fire. So you'd want to have like temperature control.
Yeah. I think the dragon figurines would probably be tempered, but we'll have to look at the clay on them.
Oh, yeah. Like is particular temper good for particular types of things? Like if you're wanting something for very high heat, you'd use one temper, but if it's just like general structure, you'd use another one?
I think it's actually more of a cultural practice in general of what's added. I think in general, any sort of silica-based, you know, temper, things like sand, crushed quartz, different crushed rocks, things like that are going to work pretty similarly. There's not going to be a huge difference, but for whatever reason, I don't know a huge amount about the cultural practice of tempering, if I'm honest, but, you know, there is certain trends are found of in different places and cultures, they tend to favor maybe crushed quartz or sand or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing is sometimes with seashells, crushed seashells and things like that, they can actually degrade over time. And also certain rocks like limestone, if you've used that, it degrades over time and kind of absorbs water into the wall of the pot. And that can also cause cracks over time. So yeah, you can have a pot that looks great. And then over time, the temper that you've added in can actually be absorbing, you know, moisture and things, and it can actually eventually lead to breaking your pot. So some tempering practices that were done in the past did actually have that sort of property to it. So yeah, it's interesting how they would sometimes use that, but it's not always the case.
Yeah. Okay. So hopefully we might even be able to see that if we see that some of the dragons are maybe, you know, starting to crack a little bit, then maybe we can say what sort of temper. Okay. Okay. So we can see things like temper potentially. What sort of, is there anything, you mentioned there's lots of things, other kinds of things can we see?
Well, I reckon we can also have a wee look at the surface decoration on the pots, on the dragon figurines. No. So I'm guessing they're sculpted little figurines that we have in front of us. And yes, I think they'll probably also have impressions or lines and things drawn on them to look scaly and dragony, you know? So we can probably see the tool marks. And yeah, you can look closely at tool marks, and with a bit of practice and a bit of experience, I suppose, you can start to figure out which tools might make similar marks. So if you're trying to make a reconstruction or something of a pot or a dragon figurine, as it may be, you could at least use a similar tool, but you don't know if it's identical unless you maybe got out, you know, microscopes and did absolutely detailed, really close-up views of the sort of tool marks left and things like this. But you can at least visually see if you've got a mark that looks at least similar to what was done on the archaeological piece. So something like you might take a piece of cordage and press it in into the clay, what they did on the Bronze Age and Neolithic beakers and things. So you can kind of tell it was definitely a cord that was pressed in, you know, that's quite obvious. In other times it might just be a pointy tool that's been scraped through the clay. But you can try and get the right sort of width of pointy tool, you know, and the right sort of depth of cut. Things like that can be quite important if you're making replicas.
You sound like you have quite a lot of experience with experimental archaeology, though. Do tell us more.
Yeah, I think it would be a really cool thing to, you know, if these dragon figurines were here, we could be making a replica of them. I don't know about bringing them to life if we made our own dragon figurine. I don't know how the magic of them works, but
I'm sure we can find them.
I'm sure we could like chat to Prometheus or something.
He's just like a couple of streets up, right? So
Moved in a big clay house.
Take around a banana bread and, you know.
I make a crack in banana bread.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, you're on banana bread. Emma will prepare the clay. I'll start my sweet talking.
He's not a fan of Terry Pratchett out here.
Oh, no.
Everyone is a fan of Terry Pratchett. They just don't realise it yet.
They don't know it yet.
Okay, so we can look at the material, we can look at the decoration. So for example, I mean, you mentioned that you make a lot of like medieval replicas and things. So what kinds of information do you try to get to know about the pot or the original, I guess, artifact before you start replicating it?
I think the first thing I normally look at is the color of the clay, the tempering, like I was just saying. So I'll have to prepare the right clay for the project, so you can tell if it's red or buff colored or, you know, you can get that basic information just by visually looking or reading. It normally tells you in a book or a report or something what color it was. And then the next thing is the dimensions. So this is where I love the people that do the archaeological illustrations and things like this, because they are incredible for making replicas. They're great. Because they've normally got the sort of dimensions of the different parts of the artifact, and then they'll also give the profile of the ceramics quite often. So they'll give the sort of thickness of the base, and then how even the wall is, and the shape of the rim, and things like this. So it's almost like a silhouette of if you'd cut the pot in half, it gives you that sort of profile of the edges and walls
like the
and everything
classic
of the pot.
Right, yeah. Like a proper proper ceramic typology, and you've got those like rows of basically lines, but they're all in a very specific shape.
But I'm such a nerd for those. I love them.
I've got a painting on my wall like that, so I'm the same.
Yes. Amazing.
Okay, so you need to find out shape, size, color, and ingredients. Okay,
and then those sort of the sort of illustrations of the pots often show how even the walls are or not. And that can give an idea of how it was made. So in the case of the figurines, we can't cut into them because they're living things. Yes. So we're not going to cut into them and thin section them, which is one way to find out if it was wheel thrown or coil built, because you can see that when you cut into the pot. But in this case, we can't do that. So we're going to have to do a bit of looking just at the surface of the objects and have a look for things like concentric lines that seem quite ordered and even, which could be an indication of wheel throwing, because as you throw the clay, your fingers just move up and leave little traces of lines as you go. So that can be quite a good indicator if something's wheel thrown, and it tends to be pretty even walls and quite round as well, quite sort of even shape. But sometimes potters are pesky and they take a tool and they can actually take away those throwing lines. So it can end up smooth and you don't have as much idea. Or it could be quite a lumpy piece. It could be a bit more uneven, you know, a bit more variation in the thicknesses and the edges and things. So that could be an indication that it might be hand-built. So coil-built or pinch pottery or something like this. Mm-hmm. But then again, people can be very skilled at hand-building as well. So they can make an incredibly even pot, even if it's hand-built. So we can have a good guess at how it was made, but... yeah, there's not always a clear line, just depending on how much skill was involved, I suppose.
I mean, this is already far more than I was getting to know when I started doing this. Because, yeah, I have no idea about things like pottery. And I mean, I guess also the final thing you mentioned before in last episode was the glaze. Which, yeah. Is there a way to, because this is something that has always amazed me, is that a glaze is different colour before it goes into the kiln compared to when it comes out of the kiln. Like, it looks different, which my dad is also a potter, and it's something that I can't get my head around. Is there a way to know when you look at a glaze what its original color was, what kind of material it comes from, or anything like that?
Not necessarily, but I suppose if you're looking at the color of the finished glaze, chances are in the past they're using things like oxides, so you know, the sort of pigments that form geologically with rocks and things. Not a geologist, so don't ask me to define what an oxide is.
If we say things with enough confidence, people just believe themselves. Geological forms, yes, minerals.
Yeah, minerals, that's the one. So they're probably using things like oxides. So, you know, things like green glazes, there's a good chance there might be copper involved, or things like lead as well. Yeah, you can get an idea just by a bit of knowledge about the colours that oxides and things produce in glazes, what's likely involved in terms of colorants. But then there's lots of other things go into glazes. So there's things like, it's normally silica based, so there's going to be things like crushed quartz again that go into glazes, or very finely ground sand or rock minerals. And you might have different clays that go in as powders. So a glaze ends up being a liquid form normally. So you'll just have a big bucket of minerals and colorants and things like this that form the glaze. It's basically a vat of liquid glass. It will ultimately become glass, pretty much.
That's
what
poetic.
Glaze is, pretty much.
Okay.
So it's a tricky one. If you're just visually looking at the glaze that's on an archaeological pot and you haven't done any chemical analysis or anything, I suppose as someone who's just making replicas, you're just aiming to make a glaze that looks visually similar or as close as you can get. Yeah, without that chemical analysis, you can't really know if you've got the same composition or not, I suppose.
Okay. I wonder if we could do XRF on the figurines to just... although they're probably not, because you probably... I don't know if XRF even works on ceramic glazes. This is something I should know, because I did a master.
I feel like it does, but don't quote me on that.
I think it depends, because I know that you can definitely use them to look at like different stone types and different like paintings to see the paints used. You know? But I wonder whether something in the glaze, the sort of sealant, you know, or something, might affect the ability of XRF machines to pick something up. XRF, by the way. Of course, as we all know from, I think we've done an episode on XRF, is X-ray fluorescence. So bombarding, as with everything with artifact analysis, you bombard your sample with various different kinds of X-rays. And depending on what comes back, shows you what kinds of, what they're called, elements are present in the sample that you're bombarding. So there you go. That's my incredibly simplified overview of XRF analysis. It sounds like we need to do a lot of experimental archaeology, basically, in order to be able to properly catalogue these little figurines.
I was also thinking, they're alive, right?
Yeah.
Can they communicate?
They can, if they want to.
We could ask.
We could ask how they're made, couldn't we?
Yeah,
we
could ask. Maybe. Oh my goodness, this is mind blowing.
Oh my god, we don't need archaeology.
We don't need a podcast. All these notes I got.
Where's that room to ask how they're made?
Like, hi, you little living guy. Can you tell us how you're made?
But would they know? No. Because surely they're not alive when they're being made.
Well, you could ask them, like, do you feel a little bit crumbly on the inside? And they'd be like, yeah, I do actually. Are you quite old? Yeah.
But do you feel shiny? You have a lot of quartz in your heart.
Do you feel that there's some sand in you?
Any dung? You can use animal dung to
any organic matter? Are you shit?
Yeah, are you poo? Are you goose poo? Are you horse poo?
Okay.
What did you just call me? Like,
do you reckon they could fire themselves as well?
They could prepare themselves. Oh, wow.
So could a dragon create another dragon?
Oh, they're grooming. This is, yeah, they're doing grooming activities. My goodness, we could watch these little guys forever.
Isn't dragon fire going to be super hot, like... Because normally with pottery firings, you want to like start super slow and you slowly heat and then you get hot and then you slowly cool because you don't want cracks forming, right? Oh. So these are going to have to be incredibly well-tempered pots to withstand dragon fire if they're firing other dragons into life or whatever, you know?
They just have good control of their fire then, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh my gosh, we should totally... Oh, wouldn't that be adorable though? A little... They have like a mini stone circle and they just do like a little firing thing. They're all... Oh. I want to write a book about this. Christian, if you're listening.
Can you write a children's book about them?
I mean, I'm trying to remember actually whether they mention anything about that in the books. I can't remember. It's a whole series. Oh. There's like four books in the series. So listeners, if you're familiar, do let us know if there's anything like that. Well, we've sorted it then. We basically just asked them.
Yeah. Sorry, Emma. We called you for absolutely no reason. No reason
at all. Yeah. Happy to talk about clay anyway.
Well, thank you anyway for coming in and helping us out with this particular problem. We very much appreciated you coming on. Is there anything before you go back on your way, because, you know, we don't need you apparently, that you would like to share with our listeners? Perhaps, I don't know, any upcoming projects or anything you feel they should know about?
Well, I suppose I've got a few things coming up this year. I've got some living history demonstrations I'm doing of sort of medieval pottery. I've got some Iron Age pottery I'm going to be doing down at the Chalk History Festival in the south of England. Cool. So a few different time periods. And yeah, I'm just always making pots from replicas. So always lots of fun, always lots of clay fun going on at the Bogborne Workshop.
And how can people best find you?
So I have a website, it's bogborne.com, and then I've got social media, Instagram, Facebook, which is at Bogborne Crafts.
Okay, perfect. And as, of course, we will definitely put them in the show notes. Well, again, thank you so much for joining us. We've definitely learned a lot, so thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So much fun.
Well, thank you to you listeners as well for joining in on this admittedly slightly tangential quest. If you enjoy these episodes, as always, please do like, subscribe, follow wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps to support the show. Also, if you're interested in hearing more archaeology content, make sure to check out the other shows on the Archaeology Podcast Network. As always, any episode ideas or just want to get in touch, you can find all of our contact information, as well as links and further information on what we discussed today and on how to keep up with whatever Emma's doing in the show notes.
By the way, Tilly, you'll need to bring your trowel with you for the next quest.
Oh, okay. Let me just grab it. Here it is.
No, not your archaeology trowel, your plastering trowel.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.archpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.